Hear ye, hear ye. The Supreme Court of the State of Wisconsin is now in session. Your silence is commanded.
Please be seated. Good morning. We have with us today students from the Wisconsin Rapids Lincoln High School. And would they please stand? We have quite a number of students, 50 according to my notes. Well, welcome. You may be seated. The students are here with us this morning in connection with the Court with Class program that the Wisconsin Supreme Court and the State Bar of Wisconsin sponsor together. This is a national award-winning program. High schools across the state are invited to join us for an oral argument. The students receive materials about the case which they are going to hear with us. And have people come in and talk with them and do some other exercises with this case. Also, in addition to hearing the case and learning about it, the students meet with a justice of the court after the case. And today, you will be meeting with Justice Brooks. And you will meet with him immediately following this oral argument. And everyone in the courtroom is invited to attend that presentation. The substantive issues will not be discussed, but the court procedure in deciding, in hearing and deciding cases will be discussed. Well, we've met you. Now let me introduce the court to you, and then you will know who Justice Crooks is. Starting on my far left is Justice Diane Sykes. Seated next to her is Justice Crooks, with whom you'll meet. To my immediate left is Justice Wilcox. I'm Shirley Abrahamson, the Chief Justice. To my right is Justice William Babbage. To his right, Justice Ann Walsh Bradley. And on the far right, Justice David Prosser. With those introductions made, we will now turn to our first case in our May oral arguments, 00-2590 CR, State v. Matthew J. Knapp. Arguing on behalf of Mr. Knapp is Robert G. LaBelle. Mr. LaBelle will argue up to 25 minutes and then have 5 minutes in rebuttal. And then Assistant Attorney General William Gansner, representing the state, will have 30 minutes. Mr. LaBelle.
Thank you. Good morning. I represent Matthew Knapp, who is the respondent, cross-appellant in this particular case. The facts, I believe, bear some consideration because they're very complicated, and the procedure in this case is complicated, and how this case got to the court at this juncture is important. Mr. Knapp was charged in a homicide that took place in 1987. He was immediately brought into custody and was ultimately released, I believe, a year later. This case was basically in the cold case status for approximately 12 years. Some information came to the cold case unit of the Attorney General's investigation unit. They then began to further investigate the case. Ultimately, Mr. Knapp was arrested in 1999. Subsequently, there were motions filed by both the state as well as the defense, which resulted in decisions which now bring us to this court. The state filed a petition, they filed an appeal by right. The defense filed a cross appeal, and the state then requested leave to appeal another order. We, as the defense, basically take issue with certain rulings of the court from Judge Koshnick. Specifically, what we disagree with is the decision by the court in refusing to suppress the physical evidence that was the derivative of the statement that was made by Mr. Knapp.
Sorry, could you repeat that, sir?
That was the derivative of the statement by Mr. Knapp that was made at the time of his arrest. As you will recall from the facts, Mr. Knapp was arrested based upon an apprehension warrant for an alleged violation of parole. The circumstances in this case are basically that the police department learned that Mr. Knapp was the very last person to have been involved with the deceased. And so they also learned that he had been drinking with the deceased. They went to the parole officer. They said, look, that's an obvious violation of his parole. We want an apprehension warrant. It was authorized. They then go to his apartment, and that becomes the area of the first contention by the defense. They go to his apartment, which is actually on the second floor. It is the second part of an upstairs-downstairs flat. There's an exterior door, which is a screen door for which you can see through, and then there's a solid wood door. The police officers, in this case, without knocking, entered both doors, went upstairs, and there accosted Mr. Knapp. Mr. Knapp was in his apartment. He could be viewed through a door into his apartment, but it had a glass panel. At that point in time, Mr. Knapp was advised that the police were there. They knocked, and they were told that Mr. Knapp was told that he was asked to come out. At that point in time, Mr. Knapp went to the telephone. Mr. Knapp attempted to call his lawyer. It is clear that that's what happened. That is not in contention. At that point in time, the officer said to Mr. Knapp, come, you have to talk to us. Mr. Knapp then put down the phone, went to the door, let the officers in, and he was apprehended. He was not Mirandized, but after Mr. Knapp asked to have some shoes put on so he could be conveyed to the station, he was then asked, where are the clothes that you wore last night? And it was important from the police officer's vantage point that Mr. Knapp pointed out those clothes because the deceased had been brutally beaten with a baseball bat. There was blood all over the scene of the particular incident, and clearly whoever perpetrated the offense had blood on him, or there was a good chance he had blood on him. So it is our contention that the first issue that this court should address is whether there was an expectation of privacy in the common area, in the area which was the upstairs stairway that led up to Mr. Knapp's apartment. It is our belief that there was an expectation of privacy.
Mr. LaBelle, let me, if I might interrupt for just a minute to clarify something. When the officer came to the apartment, was he in any way accompanied or had been in direct contact with the parole officer? Was a parole officer involved at all?
Parole officer was not there. There were two officers, as I recollect, and they did have a warrant. Whether it was in writing or whether it was simpler verbal authorization for a pickup, they had authority from the parole authorities.
To pick him up based on an alleged parole violation.
Right. And at that point in time, it was my understanding that they conveyed to the parole people that Mr. Knapp was, while they may not have used the suspect, clearly they advised the parole authorities that he was somehow connected with this particular offense.
Factually, you talked about the two doors. This is an upstairs apartment.
Yes.
Which is not owned by your client. It was owned or rented by somebody else. Is that correct? I don't want to get into that part, but just the door part. There are, you know, to go upstairs, you have to have a bottom door. So when a person knocks, which door do they come to?
There are actually three doors. There's a front door that goes into the lower flat. But this door goes up to Mr. Knapp's apartment.
Yes. But isn't that, you know, if someone's going to deliver something or go in to get his attention, you've got to go upstairs to get his attention and then rap on the door with the glass, right? No, I'm just asking.
Yes. Yeah. You have to somehow get entry.
This is a common entry where if a person was going to take a package or anything, they would walk up to.
Well, that is the dispute. It is our position that it's not a common entry.
It is not.
That is not accessible to the public. That a reasonable expectation would be that if you have an exterior door to an entryway that only leads to your living area, that should be sacrosanct and private. And that in order to gain access, there should have been some knocking, should have been some authorization to gain entryway into the upstairs stairs to get to Mr. Knapp's apartment.
And that's the way it's normally done in that apartment.
There, if you were referring to the previous case, and I think what you were referring to is the case in Wisconsin, the Edgeburg case, there was categorically no testimony at the hearing that it was the custom that people would simply walk into that entryway. To the contrary, I believe Mr. Knapp testified that normally people who came to the door that tried to go up to his apartment would yell or do something to attract his attention so that he would allow them entry.
But they would be inside that door. That's the point. In other words, they weren't yelling outside the door. They were yelling inside the door to get his attention. That's all I wanted to know.
Right.
The door at the top of the stairs, would the apartment owner lock the door at the top of the stairs?
I believe that had a locking device on it. What did not have a locking device was the exterior lower door. And so Mr. Knapp actually did have the key to his apartment.
I used to be a politician who went door to door and knocked on the doors to meet people. Would I have stopped downstairs or would I have walked upstairs?
It's our position that you would have been barred, I don't know about you personally, but one would have been barred from going into that entryway absent some indication from the tenant that you had authority to gain entry into that passageway. The second issue that is raised is probably the more fundamental issue, and that is that once Mr. Knapp, one of the more fundamental issues, once Mr. Knapp was told by the police that he was going to be taken to the station and he had placed the phone back on the receiver, at that point in time, it's our position that that was an invocation, it was an unequivocal invocation of his right to counsel. The officer testified at the hearing that he knew that Mr. Knapp's attorney was being called, and the inference was that the only reason he didn't complete the call was because the officer had beckoned him to come to the door. At that point in time, all questioning should have ceased, and anything that flowed from subsequent questioning should have been suppressed under Edwards.
A brief question with regard to that. And it seems to me, if I recall, the statement is, I'm calling or tried to call my attorney in Milwaukee.
Correct.
Something like that. That was after he had picked up the phone, put it down, and then made that statement. Seems to me, tell me why that meets the standard in Edwards of a clear and unambiguous, under Edwards, of a clear and unambiguous invocation of your right to an attorney.
I can answer it this way. An ambiguity would be evidenced if Mr. Knapp had said, maybe I should call my attorney before I talk to you, or I'm thinking about calling my attorney. In this case, he took the affirmative step, picking up the receiver, dialing the number. He apparently wasn't able to contact the lawyer for whatever reason, I don't know. But clearly here you have a demonstrated attempt to contact counsel. And I believe that.
Excuse me, I didn't mean
it's okay.
Why can't it be interpreted as you have a demonstrated attempt initially, you picked up the phone, and for some reason he hung it back up before any contact was obtained? Because, so doesn't that make it equivocal?
No, because the exchange that took place during the course of the hearings was that basically the officer standing outside of the door, he can see Knapp. Knapp can see the officer through the window. The officer's beckoning him or somehow getting his attention. The inference is, at least the logical inference that I draw from that is, that once he's on the phone and the officer's still saying, hey, come on, you know, we're going to place you under arrest, he puts down the phone. Otherwise, other consequences could have occurred, I assume, including being arrested for obstructing. Once the statement was, or strike that, excuse me, once the phone was placed on the receiver, at that point in time, he was advised he was going to be taken down to the station house. And at that point in time, Mr. Knapp, I believe, said, can I get some shoes? They took him into his bedroom, and the officer, who knew at that point, and it is our position that there was advanced knowledge that Mr. Knapp was the only suspect, then says to him, without Mirandizing him, what clothes did you wear last night? He then points to a pile of clothes, which are then seized. Mr. Knapp is taken down. That particular isolated incident, in and of itself, I don't believe says too much, except that you have to look at it in the context of this entire case. It is our belief that there is a continuum of attempts by the police officers, continuity in their efforts to avoid having Mr. Knapp be provided with his constitutional rights. It started with this first non-Mirandized statement. It progressed immediately once he was taken down to the station house, where he was again basically told, for all intents and purposes, he wasn't a suspect, we just want to know what information you've got. And at that point, again, he was not Mirandized. It then progresses to what we believe is the intentional avoidance of asking for consent for the second search, again, an intentional, purposeful act, to the last thing, which is evidenced in the 1998 or 1999 corrections interview, where they go to Mr. Knapp and they specifically say, you know, what we're here to do is we're here to investigate something totally, wholly unrelated to this incident. We're looking at an investigation for civil rights. And they again do not Mirandize him, fully aware that he is in custody. So it is our position that this particular course of conduct on the part of the police began on the very moment that they had contact with Mr. Knapp and progressed for another 12 years.
So what?
Well, the importance is that this is our argument and how the Dickerson case comes into play. And I think that, I presume that is why the court took this case in part, is to address the concerns about Dickerson that it's raised and the implications in the Yang decision in Wisconsin.
It sounds to me like you're asking this court to say where you have an intentional, knowing violation of a defendant's rights of self-incrimination by failing to give a Miranda warning, that statements and physical evidence should be suppressed. Is that the rule of law you want this case to stand for?
Let me describe it as my fallback position. My original position is to follow the dictates in Patain, and basically to say that if there's a violation of Miranda, whether it's negligent or whether it's intentional, that third-party derivative evidence should be suppressed.
Why do you want to go so broad? You've got three intentional violations of constitutional rights. You don't have to do negligence.
If you follow the philosophy of Patain, as I believe should be followed, the idea is that the United States Supreme Court has consistently held that deterrence is essential when we're dealing with police officers, and taking action to deter inappropriate conduct is important. Their position in Patain, and I think it's correctly stated, is that it doesn't matter whether it's negligent, it doesn't matter whether it's intentional, it doesn't matter what the circumstances are, the deterrent, the importance of the deterrence and making sure that officers toe the line should be so strongly told to the officers that suppression should be the consequence.
It's easier to deter if it's intentional than if it's negligent.
I would agree with you completely. And that's why Falkingham, the decision from the First Circuit, which although never came out and clearly said, yes, you can have suppression as the remedy for a violation of Miranda, clearly indicated that they were not foreclosing that option in the event there had been something intentional. In the facts in Falkingham, the officers, without any question, did nothing intentional, and without any question, the statement that resulted from the non-Mirandized situation was voluntary. And so they said, under these circumstances, we don't believe that the deterrent need is so significant that we should suppress the physical evidence.
Well, this is voluntary, too.
It is our position that it is not voluntary, and it's
not.
It's not voluntary because of the circumstances. These officers, I believe, were demonstrated over the course, as I've indicated before, from the very first contact and through the next 12 years, of a deliberate attempt and a successful attempt to deprive him of his constitutional rights. There is no question, the testimony from the officers agreed. We knew that if we advised him, he'd invoke. I don't think there could be any clearer situation where officers basically, and I give them credit for being candid, they simply said, hey, we decided we were going to do an end around because if he was Mirandized, he would invoke, and then we wouldn't get a statement, and we wouldn't get anything we wanted.
Tell me what voluntary means.
Voluntary,
me.
Sorry.
Go ahead.
Voluntary means of free will.
And so his free will here was hampered, impaired, because they didn't Mirandize him?
I believe so, and I also believe under the circumstances. They came in, again, if you start at the beginning, they come in on, I hesitate to use the word subterfuge, but clearly they obtained the parole warrant, not necessarily because they were concerned that Matthew Knapp was out drinking, but because it was a means by which to get him into custody because he was the only suspect in the homicide. And so they went to him, and they came into his apartment under the circumstances which we've described, where I believe he was deprived of his right to counsel under Edwards. And so these things start to compound, and eventually you get to the point where Knapp would not have been able to give a free and voluntary statement.
Assuming all that's true, and that's the all thrown out. I don't want to jump ahead, but your client then allegedly told people that he had committed the act. How does that play into this? Assuming all that's true, and then there were these so-called voluntary statements, and I just want to pick up he made these other statements that this alleged crime had occurred, and allegedly he had done this when he was talking to the people about all the bad things that they had done, and he got into that conversation.
The series of conversations that you're
that really had nothing to do with this 12 years.
The conversations. I'm sorry. The conversations that you're alluding to were made in a custodial status, as I understand it. It's with a cellmate or somebody with whom he was institutionalized. We take issue with the veracity of that particular individual who declares those statements were made. And so I'm not sure that it is entirely appropriate to compare the two. I understand what the court's doing, but if you assume that somehow Mr. Knapp accurately and correctly and, in fact, did give these statements, it only impacts on the voluntariness of those statements. And those individuals who heard those statements, or the individual, were not agents of the government, were not, to our knowledge, and were not acting in the capacity as agents of the government.
So the fourth, as I would say, the Clappies issue, or the issue with regard to the voluntariness in the 1998 questioning, that's purely a voluntariness inquiry. Were the statements made voluntary, or should they be suppressed? That 1998 inquiry has nothing to do with the certified question, which focuses on suppression of the fruits. Am I correct or incorrect?
With a certified question, but because the court considers all the issues, one of the things that the judge did do in this case is said, yes, that statement was a custodial statement, that statement was Mirandized, but it is still admissible for impeachment purposes if Knapp gets on the witness stand. And it's our position that not only should it be excluded because of it was non-Mirandized, but more importantly, because it was not voluntary. And not simply because a ruse was used, but because this was probably the end, or hopefully the end, of a continuum of events where there was a deliberate interference with the defendant's rights, and where they went into the situation knowing, and clearly the testimony establishes, knowing that if he was Mirandized, he would invoke. And under those circumstances, we believe it was involuntary.
Now, let me then move the analysis to the what I would call fruits issue. And that is, as I understand the basis of the trial court's decision here, which was based primarily on Yang, that the court in Yang said, hey, look, there's a Miranda violation. We can suppress the statement. But we will not suppress the fruits of that statement. And by fruits, I mean, I'm saying to the students, the evidence, the physical evidence obtained as a lead from that verbal statement. So the Yang court said, we will not we will not suppress the physical evidence if the statement meets the traditional voluntariness test.
Correct.
Is that what Yang said?
That's what Yang said.
Okay. And now I want to get to the certified question in Yang and Dickerson and the Patain case and how they all intersect. How did Dickerson, what's your position, is your position that as a result of Dickerson, every intentional Miranda violation is a constitutional violation?
According to Patain, it would be. According to Falkingham, there's a case-by-case analysis based on primarily the motivation of the officers who failed in the Miranda.
Well, my question was every intentional violation? I can't remember all of Falkingham, but I thought that Falkingham in large part had discussion about distinguishing the deterrent effect, which is the underlying premise for suppressing this stuff, and distinguishing between voluntary and negligent violations.
That's what Falkingham discussed. And it is our position that Dickerson, at the least, stands for the proposition that derivative evidence, if it is the byproduct of an intentional Miranda violation, should result in suppression, at the very least. And that's why I discussed it in the context of a fallback position. It is our argument based on Patain that it should cover both negligent and intentional. The issue, I think, with respect to Yang is that Yang was dependent largely on interpretations of Elstead and Tucker. I know that the other two decisions, the DeSuma and the Sterling decisions, say those...
The
other two decisions, which are Sterling and DeSuma from the Third and Fourth Circuits, basically take the proposition that Elstead and Tucker are controlling, and that those, the extensions of those cases are, draw a conclusion that you can't have suppression for third-party violations. It's our position that Dickerson doesn't overrule Elstead and Tucker. It simply says, from here on in, you can use suppression as a remedy. It never came out and said, look, we're saying those decisions are erroneous.
And it said, Dickerson said, you can use suppression as a remedy. That is, you may use suppression as a remedy. But am I correct that Dickerson does not stand for the proposition that you must use suppression as a remedy?
You're absolutely correct.
Then if I'm correct on that, how can you say that as a result of Dickerson, every Miranda violation should result, regardless intentional or unintentional, should result in suppression?
I don't know that the Supreme Court, when it issued the Dickerson decision, was thinking necessarily about the suppression issue. I don't know when it made those remarks if it contemplated whether it's going to be under an intentional or whether it's going to be a negligent circumstance that suppression should be allowed. And so I think clearly that's why they have taken the Patain decision on cert as recently as the day before yesterday. I reserve the balance of my time.
You have more time.
Oh, I do. I'm sorry.
Until the red light goes on.
I want to further address the issues with respect to the DeSuma and Sterling cases, and specifically why I believe they're an error. I have a stop button.
They finish that sentence and
then
sit down.
I'm done with my sentence. That's fine. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. William Gassner, Assistant Attorney General representing the state.
Thank you. May it please the court. I am Assistant Attorney General William Gassner representing the state of Wisconsin in this matter. As Mr. LaBelle has made clear and as the court obviously appreciates in this case. This case not only had appeals brought by both sides, but it's got a lot of moving parts. Let me address those parts that obviously are of the greatest importance to, I think, both as noted by the courts, certification from the Court of Appeals, which this Court accepted, and as the Court's questions have indicated. First of all, with respect to the question of the initial entry of the police officers into the stairwell entryway at the two-family flat at which Mr. Knapp was arrested in December of 1987, what we have here in the state's view is what is an extraordinarily common residential structure in Wisconsin, certainly, and in other parts of America as well. A two-family flat, as I once referred to it, two-story building with an apartment on the ground floor and an apartment on the second floor. Just as the screen door to the, if there was one, on the ground floor apartment provides a small space between the exterior world and the door that marks the entryway into the privacy of the home, to reach the truly private aspects, the comparably private portion of the second-story apartment, one had to enter through what is of necessity a longer entryway, in this case a staircase, because the building is a second-story building, a two-story building, and the actual entry into the locked, clearly private portion of the home was through a door at the top of the stairs. We know from the undisputed facts in this case that the lower door, the door that was the membrane, it was the screen that separated the outside world from the stairwell going up, did not have a functioning doorbell. No one could recall that there ever had been one. There was no lock on the door. The renters of the apartment and the landlord testified that there was no lock, and no one had had a key for it for a long time. Moreover, Judge Koshnick properly found, and I think this is undisputed, that there was no evidence of the stairwell being used as an area in which possessions belonging to whoever resided within the department were kept.
Mr. Gansner.
Yes, ma'am.
Assuming we hold that you can walk up the steps, right?
Yep.
That's what we're debating now.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Let's assume you can walk up the steps. Does that give... And ultimately what the state wants, I assume, is to get that sweatshirt into evidence. Is that right?
You bet. Absolutely.
Is that the ultimate goal?
Absolutely.
Okay. So let's get you up the steps.
Okay.
And let's say that's okay,
okay
for the moment.
Okay.
What about the entrance through that door? Is that okay?
At the top of the stairs?
Yes.
Yes.
You been debating that?
I don't think so. I don't think there's any objection to the actual entry into the apartment, because what happened there was, what the defendant first argued was...
Knock there.
Yes. What the defendant first argued was there should have been a knock and announcement at the...
Okay.
At the door before going up the stairs.
Okay, so we got him up the stairs, and he knocks and announces, and the defendant lets him in?
Absolutely. There is a clear knock, a clear announcement of purpose at the place where there should have been a knock and an
officers answer. Are in uniform or not?
I don't believe these officers. I'm not absolutely certain about this, but it was clearly announced by the officers
okay.
that they were there to effect an arrest.
You got them inside the door. All right.
The defendant opens
sweatshirt
the door.
Sweatshirt home free yet?
Not yet.
Not yet. That's
not yet.
My point. Okay.
We're moving towards it.
You're moving towards it. So
right.
You now have to overcome Miranda.
Exactly.
Okay.
All right. What we've got at that point, and that's the issue upon which the Court of Appeals certified this case, or requested certification, this court granted it. We have a case once inside the apartment where apprehending, they've clearly announced to the to Mr. Knapp that they are apprehending him. They're taking him into custody. He goes into his bedroom to complete his dressing, to get his shoes. They follow him, which was an absolutely appropriate thing to do. Once in the bedroom, with clothes lying about, they do say to Mr. Knapp, "What clothes were you wearing?" Not actually last night, but he was arrested on the 13th. The murder occurred apparently in the early morning hours of the 12th. They asked him what he had been wearing the day before. He pointed to some clothes. The officers seized those clothes.
Are you relying on plain view? It would be hard to do it because you have to pull up all the clothes, right?
No, the State did not specifically argue that. We did argue an inevitable, we made an inevitable discovery argument in the court, and we've repeated that argument here in our brief, and I think it's a fair one. But the major point that we're making here in response to the defendant is the State conceded below.
The State conceded?
The State conceded in the circuit court that there had been no Miranda warnings given to the defendant. The State conceded that there had been a Miranda violation. The State at no point has conceded that there was an intentional Miranda violation. That is, that there was, as Mr. LaBelle has described it, I think, as a apparently a 12-year conspiracy by the police to intentionally deprive Mr. Knapp of the rights that he is granted under the Fifth Amendment to the Constitution. Certainly, there's no evidence that any such conspiracy existed in 1987 when the police officers unquestionably failed to advise the defendant of his Miranda warnings.
Didn't Detective Rhodes, you know, I'm not talking about now the grand conspiracy that spans 12 years. I'm talking about the apprehension at the apartment and the subsequent, and maybe I can just stop there, but let me take it to when they get down to the department, the police department also. Didn't Detective Rhodes subsequently testify that he intentionally didn't give the Miranda? That's my understanding of the facts, because he thought that then the defendant might want to call his attorney or something to that effect.
It's my understanding, Your Honor, that there's testimony in the record that relates to the questioning that occurred once the defendant was in custody at the Watertown Police Department to that effect. I don't believe the record supports, I don't believe the record contains testimony that that was the detective's understanding or that was his intent or purpose when entering the apartment. They followed the defendant into the bedroom and said, "Where's your clothing?"
What was he doing in the apartment? What was the purpose of this visit?
The purpose of the visit was I think, clearly twofold. One, to take the defendant into custody for what was a parole violation, but I don't think there is any question whatsoever that Mr. Knapp was considered a suspect in the murder of Mrs. Bruner.
And he was under arrest at this time?
He was in custody. There is no question about it.
He was in custody. So we got rid of custody, and a question was asked, so we have interrogation.
We had a question. Without question, that's why the State conceded below, that when the police officer said, where is what clothing did you have, were you wearing on two nights ago or the night before, that was a question, no question about it.
Well, Mr. Gansel, let me just ask you this, and I don't know the record well enough to know whether there's a concession here of intent, intentionally not Mirandizing him or not, but I'm going to ask you a hypothetical.
Yes.
Let us suppose, with malice aforethought, intentionally, the police officers did not give him the Miranda warnings and asked him questions as a suspect in custody.
Mm-hmm.
What would your position be about suppression?
In our view, first, that I understand that's hypothetical, and that's what
I'm
going to address. It's our view that under the Falkingham decision, there would certainly be a basis for a court to consider whether or not the deterrent purpose of suppression would be furthered by a rule of deterrence or a holding of deterrence under those circumstances. And I think that involves a careful balancing of interests. I think the Supreme Court has made clear, and this, I think, is among the issues that the Supreme Court of the United States, now that it's just granted cert in the Patain case, which I hope was the court was aware of. We tried to bring that information to the court's attention. It was Monday of this week that the U.S. Supreme Court granted cert in the Patain case. While Patain does not appear to directly raise in that case a question of an intentional Miranda violation, given the basis upon which the United States of America asked for a certiorari in this case, a conflict among the circuits, and given the fact that the Falkingham decision from the First Circuit is one of the decisions that's brought into play here, it appears clear that the Supreme Court will give some consideration to that. I think it would be, there is certainly room for an analysis that says, if purposeful misconduct is engaged in by police officers, there is room for the courts to consider whether the deterrent purpose of suppressing evidence is appropriate. At this point, however,
why wouldn't it be? What's the balance? The fact that this is a murder case?
Well, there's two. No, I would not make such an argument, Your Honor, because I think constitutional rights don't turn upon the degree of the crime involved, but they instead turn upon what the Constitution provides. But what we have here, I think, are two things, and I think Miranda made this clear, and I think this is brought clearly into play in the Patain case and in the Third and Fourth Circuit decisions. In Miranda, as it was subsequently explained by the U.S. Supreme Court in both the Checker and the Elstad cases, and those are the cases that are brought into question, are they still good law, the Supreme Court identified that there were two rationales for excluding evidence in the context of Miranda, where there has been a Miranda violation. One of them is to deter improper police conduct.
Okay.
The second one, however, is the assurance of trustworthy evidence. Now, the evidence that we have here is clearly trustworthy. Physical evidence, by its very nature, does not present the kind of ambiguous question of intent and meaning that will typically be present in statements made by an individual. That's why Miranda, we think, as Tucker and Elstad made clear, is properly limited to the suppression of statements and not to physical evidence. Because there is no question in the situation of physical evidence that the evidence is trustworthy. There's no ambiguity about the sweatshirt here. It contains blood that matches the victim's.
Are you arguing that Dickerson had no effect on Elstad and Tucker?
It's argued that Dickerson did not change Elstad or Tucker, and I think the Supreme Court perhaps more artfully could have made that clear, but I think the Supreme Court attempted in Dickerson to make that clear, that what the Supreme Court was holding was in saying that Congress could not overrule Miranda, effectively, that Miranda had a constitutional basis because it was a court-made rule designed to protect a constitutional right.
But
it didn't overrule Tucker or Elstad.
Tucker, Elstad, and Yang, our case, based on Tucker and Elstad, was premised on Miranda only being prophylactic, and that it didn't implicate a constitutional rule or have a constitutional basis. That was the premise of Yang, as I understand it.
Well, I think that's right. I think another way to look at that, and I think this becomes a nuanced matter, is that what those cases were based upon was a recognition that suppression of evidence under Miranda should be limited only to those things at which Miranda was aimed, that is, statements, not physical evidence. That the suppression of physical evidence was very different because the very nature of the evidence is different than statements. The physical evidence will typically not have ambiguity, and the evidence itself, the piece of physical evidence itself, is not the product of a compulsion, whereas a statement that Miranda was designed to ensure would be free and voluntary, a statement without warnings was deemed to be presumptively compelled until that presumption could be overcome. The case of a piece of evidence itself, a gun found in an automobile, a gun found under a bed, here the sweatshirt lying in the room, there was nothing compelled about its existence, whereas the statement itself produced by a suspect could be presumptively, its existence was compelled by the inherently coercive circumstances of unwarned custodial interrogation. I think that's what Tucker and Elstad, and I think Dickerson, continues to recognize, that there is a significant doctrinal difference between what the Fifth Amendment was designed to do under the prophylactic rule of Miranda, protected by the prophylactic rule of Miranda, and what the Fourth Amendment was designed to do. The Fourth Amendment specifically directed at physical evidence. The Fifth Amendment under the Miranda rule specifically directed at statements by a defendant or a suspect.
Counsel, what if during the course of a admittedly illegal search, mm-hmm. with the defendant standing there, the police Mirandize the defendant, and the defendant confesses? Is that admissible?
So we have a question there of whether the statement may have been tainted by the initial Fourth Amendment illegality.
Mm-hmm.
I think we've got an established form of analysis for dealing with that, whether or not a statement was the fruit of a Fourth Amendment violation. So I think we've got, conceivably it may be.
Conceivably it what?
Conceivably the statement which followed from, if there was an acknowledged Fourth Amendment violation, it is conceivable that the statement could be suppressed. And we've got, I think we have an established method of analysis for dealing
with. What is that established method of analysis?
Well, I think it has to do with whether or not the statement itself is directly the fruit of the Fourth Amendment violation, the mere presence of the police officers, for instance.
Okay, so, well, to turn it into a more understandable example, maybe, an illegal arrest without probable cause,
mm-hmm.
and then the defendant's Mirandized. Totally appropriate Mirandized, but there's, you know, no questions of any mm-hmm. in-between stuff. He's immediately Mirandized and he confesses.
Mm-hmm.
That, I take it, is suppressed.
Well, I think what we have in those circumstances is an analysis that looks at whether or not the statement was sufficiently free from any taint from the initial legality. There's a circumstantial totality of the circumstances analysis that we look at under those circumstances. It may very well be that the statement was entirely voluntary, given after proper Miranda warnings, and sufficiently free from any taint arising from the Fourth Amendment illegality. And if so, the statement's good.
How can you get it sufficiently free the way Justice Babbitt set up the fact situation?
Well, it would really depend. I think we'd need maybe a little more detail on the facts, what the time was between the initial legality and the obtaining of the statement.
30 seconds.
The circumstances that existed in between.
30 seconds. 30
seconds.
Okay.
Enough time to read the Miranda card.
Right. I think we'd need to know something about the age, experience, and mental circumstances of the individual, whether or not how the warnings were delivered, whether the police officers had drawn guns, the extent of what was the illegality.
You had coercion. You're not looking at attenuation.
Well, what I'm talking here about is the method in which the Fourth Amendment violation occurred. And whether or not there may have been coercive aspects in the illegality of the search, which could be viewed reasonably as creating a taint that in a very short period of time continued to run to the statement.
I took it to an arrest. There's no probable cause, but he's placed under arrest. You're under arrest. There's no probable cause. And now here's your Miranda rights. And the guy says, you got me, I did it.
Well, I'm going to be here arguing that under the circumstances that you just described, that you've got a voluntary and a knowing and voluntary waiver of Miranda rights, and you've got a proper statement.
Let's assume that there is a taint, that there is no attenuation, that it's, you know, it's bad, bad, bad. You seem to be espousing that a tainted Fourth Amendment is not acceptable, but a tainted Fifth Amendment is acceptable. You seem to be advancing the premise that there is less of a need to deter a Fifth Amendment violation than there is a need to deter a Fourth Amendment violation.
Well, I think I am, and I think that's what the United States Supreme Court has said. And in particular,
does that make sense?
Yes. For the reasons that I believe that Justice O'Connor in New York versus Quarles in her concurring opinion said that that the deterrent concerns under Miranda and under the Fifth Amendment do not justify suppressing physical evidence in addition to an unwarned statement. That the statement is what is specifically designed to be protected. And wherever
don't
she said,
"Don't you need the statement here? I wore that last night."
Oh, it would be helpful, but is it absolutely necessary? No.
You're not going to introduce that then?
The statement? No, it can't be. It's been suppressed from the state's case in chief, and that's precisely what Justice O'Connor and Quarles said was the sufficient remedy. The sufficient remedy, sufficient under most circumstances to deter police misconduct, is disallowing the statement.
Okay,
but
look,
don't disallow the evidence.
Okay.
Don't disallow the physical evidence.
Disallow the statement here, and the statement clearly, you're not contesting that issue
it's
at
out.
All. It is out of it.
Unless the defendant says something different, in which case the state can use it for impeachment.
But here's a sweatshirt with blood on it. You know, I think that, oh, not just blood on it, by the way, the deceased person's blood on it. You know, it seems to be kind of important,
sure.
I imagine, in the scheme of things.
Sure.
I said before that something has to make, you know, sense, the difference between deterrence and Fourth Amendment and Fifth Amendment.
Mm-hmm.
I want to set aside all of the law
mm-hmm.
and just talk about making good sense.
Yes.
In my, you know, but what my sense is good sense.
Right.
Might be different than yours. If I want to deter, and that's what suppression is about, deterring misconduct,
mm-hmm.
police misconduct.
Mm-hmm.
And let's say it's intentional police misconduct. Let's say they intentionally didn't give the Miranda warning.
Mm-hmm.
And let's say in the future, now it's not going to be just Watertown, but after this case, and we follow your position, good old Wausau and Bevent and Stevens Point and Appleton and Hurley and Racine and Janesville, none of the police officers are going to give Miranda. Why? We don't need to. Why? Because nothing happens if we don't. There's no deterrence. That doesn't make sense to me when you're talking about a violation of what is a constitutional rule. So how can there be any deterrent effect at all? You know, these kids are going to say, you know, if there are no teeth in it, I'm going to do it because I can get what I want. I want the evidence. I want that shirt. So I don't care how I get it. I can violate the Constitution and it's okay, because no one's going to do anything about it. How do you respond to that kind of, forget Elstead, Tucker, Yang, Dickerson, just talk about good old deterrence.
Okay. All right. I would be drastically concerned about this issue had there been any evidence over the last 20 years that this was a significant problem. And I think it is fair for this court to look at this question. It has only been in the aftermath of Dickerson when the Supreme Court, in order to preserve the suppression of evidence as a result resulting from a violation of Miranda, from a seeming congressional enactment designed to overrule the requirement of suppression, said, uttered language that has given rise to the kind of argument that the defendant is making here, that we've even confronted this fact. Miranda has been in existence since 1966. Our research, and I'm sure the court's recognition of this matter, reveals an extraordinarily small number of cases in which any issue has arisen over knowing violations of Miranda, if indeed that's what we have here, and we're not conceding that that's what happened here in 1987, purposeful violations of Miranda, there have been very few cases that have even raised the question that's being raised now. This has not been, there is no significant evidence that this has been a serious problem in police, in jurisprudence, but moreover in police practice, and I think there's a clear reason why. The police understand how Miranda works. It's a rule that's relatively easy to apply. Police may not be any more fond of it than they were when it was first announced, although there's been an entire generation of police officers who have grown up with it, but they understand how it works. And they understand as well that when there is a violation, what the remedy for the violation is, which is the suppression of the statements, not the suppression of evidence that might have been uncovered as a result.
Could another explanation be for Napa's deluge, as this trial court did, that he relied on our case, State versus Yang, which was decided in 2000, relatively recently?
Right. That's a possible explanation, but I think there was an explanation long before Yang why the courts had not been flooded with these kinds of cases. The Miranda rule is one that is relatively easy for the police to apply. It's relatively well understood, thanks to a combination of courts, police training, television, and movies. Everyone understands how it's supposed to work. I guess it's probably the most publicized legal rule in existence.
So what happened here?
What happened?
Twice he didn't get a Miranda warning. What happened?
Well, what happened at the apartment in 1987 is that the police officer simply didn't do it. I don't think we know from this record whether this was an intentional violation.
Well, but even if it's negligent, if it's so clear and it had been in effect for 20 years, it had been on TV, et cetera, the police officers did not give a Miranda here.
They did not, and the state conceded that. The question is what the remedy then becomes. And we know that under Miranda, the remedy is...
If it's so clear and it's so easy, how come they didn't give it?
Well, I can't explain why police officers don't always do what, in the clear, rational, dispassionate months, if not years thereafter, is easy for others, myself included, to
this
say it could have been done.
This wasn't an emergency. I mean, it's not like they're racing up the stairs in hot pursuit of someone who just killed and the guy forgets to give him a Miranda. I mean, they're going up the stairs. There's several of them. Parole violation.
Yeah.
They got plenty of time.
I can't say why the police officers did not Mirandize the defendant.
Why didn't they Mirandize him in, when they were in prison talking to him?
Oh, I think it's clear what the police officers were doing there. The police officers were looking for evidence that might assist them in investigation, but were not looking for any evidence that would be used in court.
Counsel's the only time that he said something...
They were not looking for admissible evidence.
Is the only time that he said something about wanting an attorney at the apartment? Was that the facts?
That's my understanding, that was the only occasion on which there was a reference to counsel.
I then point to appendix page 377, which refers to that communication and the clothing and the communication about not wanting an attorney. And the question on page 377, you abandoned the notion of reading him his constitutional rights based on what he told you relative to wanting an attorney, right? Answer, that's accurate, yes. And you wanted to keep the lines of communication open, and you were concerned, were you not, that if you had Mirandized him at that point, that he might not make a statement, right? Answer, that's accurate. All right. As you knew, in fact, if you didn't Mirandize him, he wouldn't, because you had preceded the reading of the rights by telling you wouldn't, because you would have preceded the reading of the right by telling him, not telling him that he was a suspect, that you just wanted his help. That's why he was there, to assist you in finding the perpetrator of the crime. It sounds to me like that is directly focused on and contemporaneous with the event of when he's saying his attorney was in Milwaukee. He was calling his attorney in Milwaukee. Do you interpret that differently? In other words, I understand your position to be that Rhodes intentionally did not Mirandize him, but that only was at the office or at the police department and not at the apartment. Is that your position or not?
Well, there's no question that the testimony is what it is from the officer about what happened at the apartment. No, I have not. I'm not suggesting here that the testimony is any different. That is, in fact, what was stated at the in the officer's testimony.
I mean, it was a leading question that
yes.
I just referred to,
yes.
And you wanted to keep the lines of communication open, and you were concerned, were you not, that if you had Mirandized him at that point, that he might not make a statement, right? Answer, that's accurate.
That's exactly what the officer testified to.
And that, well, that leads me to think that he intentionally didn't Mirandize him because he wanted him to make a statement and that that was intentional.
I wish I could look into the mind of the police officer well enough to know that that's what his intent was. I don't think that intent is clear. I don't think such an intent is clearly demonstrated.
Did the trial court find that intent on the basis of these statements?
Did the trial court make such a finding of intent? No.
Rather, it didn't.
It did
could,
not.
Could a trial court make such a finding on the basis of these statements?
Your Honor, I'd argue that the evidence was certainly equivocal. I don't think it would support the drawing of such a conclusion because it's not clear from under the circumstances precisely. In other words, could the court draw the inference that the police officer intentionally intended to elicit an incriminating statement from the defendant?
Right.
I think it's at least equivocal. I don't think that would support the drawing of that finding.
What do you think it says?
Well, this may be one of those situations that it's just hopelessly ambiguous about what the officer's intent was.
I think this case should go back to the trial court to find out whether this was intentional. And the reason I say that, counsel, it just seems to me that it is an arguably good position that where a police officer intentionally, with full knowledge of the issue of Miranda, deliberately decides not to give the Miranda rights and keep the defendant talking, I should say suspect talking, to get an incriminating statement, whether it be about physical evidence or another statement, that there's nothing to balance against deterrence. If that isn't enough, it's nothing, no case. And maybe that is an issue that ought to be explored in this case.
That would certainly, if that's what the facts of this case demonstrated, the posture of this case might be very different, and we might not be here.
What's the state's position?
I don't think the record of this case supports the drawing of that conclusion. And thus, if it is this court's view that the record is ambiguous on this subject, then it appears to me that a remand might be appropriate. But the record certainly does not support, at this point, in our view, the drawing of the conclusion that the officer was engaged in an intentional, deliberate effort to deprive this defendant of the rights under
Where's the defendant now?
He's in county jail.
Pardon me?
He's in jail awaiting the outcome of this case.
Is he...
He was earlier, as you know from the record, serving a prison sentence, but he's now in jail.
My question is he still under a prison sentence?
I'm not certain whether or not his sentence has fully expired, whether he was MR'd and that resulted in his custody in the jail. I don't know, Your Honor. I did not check what the actual cause
jail.
Of his
he's
custody.
He's not on bail.
No, he's in jail. He is incarcerated.
And will continue to be incarcerated until this decision is made.
And until the case is tried.
And the case is tried.
Unless the circuit court were to grant release on bail. And to my knowledge, there's been no such application.
And for the time of this crime until, it would have been 1998, was he in prison?
He was in prison at the time of his interrogation by the two agents. I don't know exactly when he was released. I'd be happy to provide that information to the court. That hasn't been an issue in the case up until now, and I realize that this case has had a protracted history, but I'd be happy to provide that information with the court. It can easily be done.
You don't know when he was released from prison?
I don't know the date of his release from prison. No, I do not, Your Honor. I'd be happy to get that information and could easily provide it to the court.
Do you have any objection?
No.
Thank you, Mr. Gansner.
Okay. Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. LaBelle.
And I do not believe that there is any ambiguity in whether the officers, upon their initial contact with Mr. Knapp, were acting intentionally, negligently, or in the heat of the moment. And there is another factor from which the court can draw certain conclusions, and that is that when Mr. Knapp picked up the phone and called his lawyer, whether it rose to the level of an Edwards violation or not, the fact of the matter is that the officer clearly knew at that point that he had made an attempted to make contact with his counsel. At that point, the only logical action by an officer, an experienced police officer, would have been to advise him of his Miranda warnings. And he chose not to do it. And the only conclusion that I think is appropriately drawn from that conduct in that sequence is that he intentionally, purposefully withheld the Miranda warnings so that, as the Court just read, he could continue and the open lines of communication in an attempt to get information. The posture that has been taken by the State in this argument leads to the conclusion that if we don't sanction officers who intentionally withhold Miranda warnings, what sort of message do we send to the law enforcement community? It basically says, here's what you guys can do. You can go out to the street. You can take somebody into custody. Hopefully they will have physical evidence, or you can arrest them in their homes where physical evidence might be. You don't Mirandize them. You ask them statements. They lead you to the physical evidence, and you've got it. And it seems to me that if we're talking about the real purpose of deterrence, as the Supreme Court has discussed it in previous cases, that's what we're trying to avoid. In Los Angeles, anecdotally, officers are routinely making arrests and not Mirandizing people, knowing that those statements that are not Mirandized can be used in Harris. That's the type of deterrence that we're attempting to use in this case. We're trying to avoid having those type of pieces of law enforcement efforts come into a court of law. In this particular case,
could I ask, how would the State prove that the blue sweatshirt belonged to the defendant and was worn at the time that the victim and the defendant were together?
Because the statement has been suppressed?
Pardon?
You mean because the statement has been suppressed?
Yeah.
Because the only logical conclusion that a jury would draw is from the following facts. The defendant is arrested the morning after the homicide. He's arrested in his home. He's arrested in not close proximity, within inches of a pile of clothes, which I assume the State is going to attempt to show fit perfectly Mr. Knapp. And I think the logical conclusion is that that, in fact, is exactly what Mr. Knapp wore, and the DNA on Mr. Knapp's clothes belonged to Ms. Bruner. So I don't – the statement is a nice thing. It's a call, it's a nexus. It's a link. But I don't think it's an integral part of the State's case. And I think clearly, unless this Court were to suppress the physical evidence that was seized at the time of arrest, I think that evidence will come in and will be compelling.
And if he were to take the stand, they would use that statement as a to impeach him.
That's correct, because the Court did not find it was involuntary or an Edwards violation. And it's our position that it is both.
He can't take the stand because that's going to be used against him.
That is correct. Well, if that's the risk he takes, that's correct.
Would there be other witnesses who could identify the blue sweatshirt as belonging to the defendant?
I don't remember the facts. Are there other witnesses that identify Mr. Knapp as being the last human being in contact with the deceased within hours of what's established as the time of death? I don't remember specifically that they're able to confirm that those are the clothing. And I don't think the record shows that any individual has ever sat down with the clothing and specifically identified that clothing as that which was worn by Mr. Knapp. There are no further questions. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. LaBelle. Thank you, Mr. LaBelle, and thank you, Mr. Gansner, for arguing this important case that apparently is one that's similar to others across the country and now before the United States Supreme Court. This closes our session on 00-2519-CR State versus Knapp. The students will remain here, and Justice Crooks will be out momentarily to discuss the case. And everyone else is cordially invited to stay.